Welcome to the Say What podcast. This week, we have the whole team helping to get us going on this wonderful journey together. We have our worship pastor, Cody Kajawa, our executive pastor, Michael Robbins, our kids minister, Anna Kajawa, and our student pastor, David Parmar. Today, we're going to get you caught up with where we have been in the preaching series at First Salina, most recently called Best Sermon Ever, the Sermon on the Mount. Today's topic, we're going to be diving into four questions that we got from the audience on keeping it salty and the topic of lying. So I know there's been a lot of excitement about the podcast, and that's gotten us excited because it would be a lonely thing for just the staff to be excited about this. And we got a ton of questions in. So the team has already worked together on some of these, and it's been really cool to hear how the sermon is landing into the audience. It gives us a special pastoral insight into what's going on in the eyes and minds and hearts of those that it's fallen upon. So, Michael, thank you so much, very much for the hard work you've put into curating this list. And I just want to give a precursor. Thank you to the team for carving out of a very busy schedule the opportunity for us to get together on this first one and all dialogue on, well, these questions.
Yeah, let me just say this. As we get started, I'm so grateful for every question we got yesterday. Each one of the questions was really interesting and provided such unique insight from the sermon and the Bible passage. Now, we don't have time to cover every question each week. We don't have time to answer them all, but that doesn't say anything about the quality of the questions. They've been fantastic. So please keep them coming. We are so excited to hear from you and get a chance to answer some of the things that you've asked of us. Question number one that I will pose to you, Pastor Jacob, is this. This person asked, hey, we've shown that we can't even keep the Ten Commandments perfectly. Will we ever be able to live this fully? Should we be simply looking for the fruits of these attitudes, or are we expected to always live them? They said, I'm fearful because I don't always see these things in my life constantly, especially in traffic or when I'm wronged. It guilts me.
I know that I can personally testify to my best moments are not always whenever I am caught up on traffic up here in North Texas. So I would certainly hope that the expectation from the Lord is not perfection. And I don't think that it is. I find it really interesting that right here at the beginning of this best sermon ever, which is definitely not because I'm preaching it, it's because the Lord preached it, that the Lord told that group that was gathered on the side of that mountain that I'm coming to fulfill the law and the prophets. Don't discount the previous rules, but know that they're fulfilled in Him. I think that sets up nicely an appreciation for grace. Now, I do want to say that anybody that's listening, this is the kind of preaching series that builds upon itself. So if at any point you feel as though we're talking about something that you don't remember, please go back to previous messages and listen to what we were talking about there. It will be a lot for us to try to recap everything that has been said. But when it comes to, are we expected to keep this perfectly? You know, really that sermon that we talked about on grace, whenever Jesus talks about, hey, I'm coming to fulfill the law and the prophets. I didn't come to abolish it. That abolition comment that Jesus made means that the law is not abolished for us, but it's fulfilled for us. In the sermon on that, we talked about how grace is that undeserving favor should equal an unrelenting fervor. That actually Jesus fulfilling those commandments does not mean that they're irrelevant for our life, but it should inspire us to an excellent life. The call of the gospel, and I believe the call of this Christian portrait, which is all the Beatitudes, that it's not like you grade yourself and I'm getting a C minus or an A plus or I'm failing, but it's a portrait. It's the portrait of the image of God. It's the portrait of Jesus. And as we're looking at it, we're not hoping to do one and not another, or one pacifies the not taking another one serious, but rather that we're trying to take very seriously the perfection Jesus fulfills for us. And I think that that leads to an excellent life, an excellent moral life that we're supposed to, well, resemble to the world. That's what the salt means. But I'm interested to hear, what are you thinking about whenever you're reading this question? Because, you know, I only have one perspective, and we got the whole team here today, so I'm excited to hear what they've got to say about these four questions too.
So when I first read this question, and I actually read it live when it came in during the sermon, when I read live this fully, I actually differentiate that from live this perfectly. I consider live this fully to be, would be someone who is marked by that trait. Like, this guy is honest. That woman is incredibly honest. That person is that trait. And so I think you can separate those. The expectation, obviously, if we want to do what we've been asked to do, commanded to do, is to not sin. But we can, even though we can't do that, we will fail. We can still live these truths fully. We can be marked by these traits.
Yeah. I keep going back to the fruit part of this question too. Like, I think about the fruit that's been sitting on my countertop for over a week. It starts to look mushy, you know, because its proximity to the vine has been too long to where it's not healthy on its own. And so when we start to think about fruit in our life, it makes a difference how far we've been apart from the Father, right? Mm. And that's a choice that we get to make every day. But the fruit of how much time we've spent in Him comes out in those moments, maybe even in traffic where we might fail and not get it right. But you can tell how much time we've spent trying to emulate our Father and look more like Him. And that goes back to the portrait of Christian living. Yeah, we're not going to get it right. And it's going to be really obvious when we haven't spent time with Him.
Mm. I really appreciate the honesty of this question where it finishes with, it guilts me. Mm. Because a lot of us feel guilt when we fall short, when we don't live the way that we know we're supposed to. And I think continuing to remind ourselves that we're going to fall short, we're not perfect, but we're aspiring to be like Jesus, to pursue that excellent life that you're talking about, Pastor Jacob, is what keeps us going. Just a reminder to continue to press on through that guilt, knowing that's just a part of being human in this world.
That's some really good insight. I couldn't agree more. And David, one of the things you just said about what we're aspiring towards, you know, so much of our Christian walk is judged by our aspirations. Now, I want to be totally honest that, you know, whenever I was outside of the church, one of my biggest critiques of the church is that they're all hypocrites. And, you know, I think it's hilarious because we're all hypocrites to some degree. So it's a little unfair from the outside looking in. I look back at the younger me that would have hurled that insult at the church. And I think that now that I'm a pastor, I've heard this before and I've said it before actually too, is that, like, well, if your hesitation towards the church is that, oh, it's just things you aspire towards, you don't live up to, you all are hypocrites, I would like to say on the record that we always have room for one more.
Right.
So come on and join us.
Right.
Christianity really is judged by its aspirations. And I think that what Jesus is doing with this portrait of Christian living, these Beatitudes, we have just simply called them blessed attitudes. It reminds me so much of that scene in Patriot, The Patriot with the Mel Gibson film, where it's this really emotional moment and this intense moment where I know that every man, every woman, when they're watching the screen, they're asking, well, what would I do in this moment? It's whenever the oldest son is actually captured by the Redcoats. Well, that happened on Mel Gibson's character on their land. So he cuts them off at the pass and he brings his two younger sons. He hands one of his sons the rifle. And here's the thing that stands out. As the Redcoats are coming around the bend with his older brother in chains, he is saying to himself what his dad had taught him whenever he was learning how to shoot the rifle. He's whispering to himself to calm himself down, aim small, miss small, aim small, miss small, aim small, miss small. I think that what Jesus is doing with that portrait of Christian living, those blessed attitudes that we have covered over and over and over again throughout this preaching series, he's given us a very small target. That way, when we miss small. Mm-hmm. The Lord, He is the one who fulfills the Old Testament expectations. He's the sacrifice given. But what that should do in our own lives is not make us feel as though we have this incredible burden that we can't possibly fulfill, but give us the freedom to aim small and miss small. So I've often said that God didn't call us to perfection, but He does call us to excellence. I think that the more that we fire at a small target, the smaller we'll miss, and the more that we commit ourselves to shooting the shot, the less we'll miss, the less we'll miss, the less that we'll miss. And I believe that that's what the Holy Spirit does in the believer that's sincerely taking God's expectations and applying them to their life. That excellence normally does not mean that we're going to have a lot of money in the bank account. It typically does not mean that you're going to see a lot of worldly success, but I think it's exactly the moral excellence that Jesus is expecting us to be salt and light with, which is also a previous part of this beginning of that sermon. So what a great question. I totally agree, Anna, that it's kind of like the fruit and the vine. How far away? Well, how close are you really looking at that portrait? And are you using it to describe how you're looking in your day-to-day?
I love it. Going into the next, just really excellent question is this. It says, up to this point. Now, I believe this person's asking, when they say up to this point, they mean in the context of Scripture that we have covered, we've been covering. They say, up to this point, Jesus had been more concerned about the hearts of the people. Is this topic of lying based solely on outward oaths, or is he still more concerned about the hearts of the people making the oaths?
So this is a great question that gets us, I think, to the real context of yesterday's sermon. Yesterday's sermon, the title was Keeping It Salty on the Topic of Lying. Now, we're in a part of the Sermon on the Mount where we're calling it the Keep It Salty section, because this is where Jesus starts making application to the way that people need to be salt and light in their local spheres of influence. So 3 weeks ago, we began with the first one he brought up. It's six different topics, but the first one is keeping it salty on the topic of anger. The next week, we covered keeping it salty on lust, and we combined that with lust and marriage. And then yesterday, the most recent sermon is keeping it salty on the topic of lying. So whenever they talk about these oaths, that section is Jesus, I believe, is talking broadly about all of our commitments. So yesterday, what we did during the sermon is we sort of built this house. The roof of the house was commitment. And the third floor of this big house that we're building is commitment is built on honesty, truthful transparency. As we built downward on the house to that second floor, honesty is built on integrity. And then integrity is built on credibility. So when this person asks this question, I think it's a really, really good one. Is Jesus more focused on the heart or the actual doing? Now that I've gotten people caught up with actually what was discussed yesterday, man, I would love to know, man, what are you thinking on this question? Where do you think they're coming from whenever they're asking about the hearts?
Yeah, so for me, when I saw this question as well, I just kind of had an immediate reaction. The reaction for me is that I think any outward oath, anything that comes out of your mouth is showing your heart. I would find it incredibly difficult to find the person whose heart is pure, but they always lie, right? Like those things can't be connected. Matthew 15:18 is the one that always pops in my mind when I think about this. It says, but what comes out of the mouth proceeds from the heart. Whatever is in your heart comes out of your mouth. So I don't think you can have both. I don't think you can only be focused on the heart and neglect what comes out of your mouth. The two are very much connected.
Well, I was going to say the answer is yes. I mean, the question is asking, is he more concerned about the hearts or is it the outward oaths? I mean, it's both and. Mm-hmm. You can't be just concerned with the heart or just concerned with what, it's all a full circle that you're trying to make with what he's saying here, talking about lying specifically.
Yeah.
One thing that we consistently tell our students is, you know, what you fill your heart with, it will come out. And I think it's one of those, it's a similar situation here with the concept of lying where it's lockstep with the idea of oaths. It will come out, but it starts with the heart.
Yeah, it's kind of like Jesus is saying, because I am worried about what's coming out of your mouth, I am worried about your heart. There's almost like a false separating of the two. You know, there's a false dichotomy that's being made that what comes out of our mouth is what's in our hearts. And a question like this, I worry, maybe trying to leave room for, well, hey, if I really blow it on this whole lying thing, doesn't Jesus just kind of love my heart? Like, I had this pure intent, but impurity came out.
Yeah.
I think that bumps up against something really important that happens in a lot of my pastoral counseling. It's the difference between sins of omission and sins of commission. So far, what Jesus is doing is he is setting up a really high standard, okay? But that's exactly what he's going to do whenever he's asked, hey, what's the greatest commandment? The Lord actually gave two. He says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, and with all your soul. Can I state something here just as a statement of real humility? Here I am, a lead pastor at First Alina. We hope to see you soon. And I hope that this statement doesn't detract from you wanting to come. I'm just being totally honest, all right? So the Lord, whenever he answers it that way, I already am in a constant state of omission because I omit that sin. Y'all, I don't know if I, for one second of my entire life, have loved the Lord my God with all of my heart, with all of my mind, with all of my strength. I don't know if I've done it for one second. I do love the Lord, but I feel like that's a standard I'm constantly omitting. That is a sin of omission. That's very different than lying. Now, I will say, and want to make sure that I'm on the record saying this as well, that the Lord didn't stop there. He says, also love your neighbor as yourself. In those two, all the prophets and the law flow. I don't know if I've ever loved my neighbor perfectly as I love myself. I'm pretty sure that on the two most important commandments, I am successfully omitting that sin all the time. I'm committing that sin of omission. Now, that does keep me humble. But that's very different than sins that we commit. Think about lying for a moment. The moments that we lie, we're typically reacting to something, which means there's a real choice to be made there. You don't stumble into a lie. You decide to lie. I don't decide proactively to not love the Lord my God with all my heart, with all my mind, with all my soul. Those are aspirational. I don't proactively not love my neighbor as myself. Those are aspirations. So I would hate for the person that is saying that, well, isn't Jesus mostly concerned with my heart? I think they're confusing here that lying is a sin of commission, not a sin of omission. When we have lied, we have chosen actively to participate in something we know to be wrong. That's very different than sinning by omission. And I think that if we look at ourselves in this false dualism of being to where we have, I in my heart wanted this, but I've proactively with my body done this, that's a silly way to view sin itself. This is a sin that we commit. Lying is never okay. Jesus is going to say in this 37th verse that anything more comes from evil. Anything more than telling the truth, and anything that's being used more to qualify what we're promising, it comes from evil. I think that pretty clearly stamps out the difference between omission and commission. And I would never want to give an inroad where we can treat grace like it's cheap to pacify the lies that we tell. Yeah. So, yeah, Jesus is really worried about the heart. That's why he's also worried about what's coming out of our mouth.
That's right.
Question number 3 of 4 for this week. The sermon dealt with keeping our promises and honoring our vows, but where do you come down on white lies? The questions like, do I look fat in this dress? Or compassionate lies like, did they suffer before they died? Are they justifiable or are all lies equal?
At the risk of sounding holier than thou and at the risk of causing a lot of internal disputes in households, all lies have a place of origin, and it's not heaven. They all come from the father of lies, who is Satan. And even though there are lies, I think, that will pacify a moment, this is not a zero-sum game we're playing with. Now, I think I have some more to say on that, but I would love to know, what were y'all thinking whenever you read this question? Because I think that this might be, of the four, the most relatable question that we have. Mm-hmm. These white lies, compassionate lies, almost sounds like an oxymoron, a compassionate lie, because I think that we can make the case that there's no such thing, but I know what they mean. They're typically said a lot of times between husband and wife, but I'm really, really excited to hear, what are y'all thinking when y'all read this question?
So you said in the sermon on Sunday, you talked about how our three biggest commitments are to God, to family, and to the church. And then the Bible shows, we walk through how commitment is built on honesty, integrity, and credibility. I think that makes it incredibly difficult to justify even the white lie. Right? I think often what we do is we claim something as a white lie, when in reality, it's just because we don't want to have to confront maybe a pinch point in a relationship, in a job, in our own actions. That can be really tough.
It's kind of ironic. I'm going back to the fat dress situation because all wives have asked their husbands that. And maybe we should, you know, just say now that
that's
we're
an
sorry.
Unfair question.
Yeah, it's not necessarily fair. It could fall. Maybe people would see that and think about that could be a lie of omission, right? Because you're trying to be kind or you're trying to not make it harder than it has to be. But it's kind of ironic that this is all built on honesty. So if we're not being honest, then we're not being fair to our spouse or kind, really. And if we've asked the question, we probably already know the answer, and it's probably not fair to ask them to answer that. So I don't think that it's okay. I think that that brings up further conversations and trust that you need to have in your spouse specifically for that question. But
it's tough because it's a very real question. It boils down to what's been said, that lies are not okay. I think what we end up doing is we often tell a white lie, or what you could say a compassionate lie, because we don't want to confront the situation. We say, if we lie right now, it'll be okay. I'll fight that battle later, which is not the right mindset. And so when I'm looking at this question, it's flashbacks of my life where I've done things like this to get out of a situation to then 5 minutes later find myself in, ooh, I'm in deep water. And so I think it's just being okay with confronting the uncomfortable situation, just telling the truth, because it will be worth it. I can tell you that from experience, it will be worth it.
So for every good old boy that might be listening to this who is thinking to themselves, or maybe you have said it out loud right now, well, you don't know my wife. I think that David is right on this. I think that it is good to make sure that you're always being honest. It's not kind to tell her she looks good in this dress when she doesn't, which is kind of like the stereotypical lie. But we all know that these white lies go a little bit broader than just like, how do I look in this? I think the whole idea of a compassionate lie or a white lie rests on a false assumption, which is that there is a such thing as a good lie. Well, if every lie has the same origin, then there's no such thing as a good lie. It's not a zero-sum game. Whenever our wives or our spouses ask that infamous question, how do I look in this? I think in those moments, one of the reasons why we punt on that moment, we say the white lie, honey, you look great. Even whenever we know that they don't, which is not kind. I think one of the reasons why we do that is because maybe that's the total sum of the feedback we're given. You know, we really, all of us have love tanks. And it's in those moments that you don't want to be running on E whenever that question lands on you. And it's, hey, how do I look, honey? You really want there to be some miles in the tank that you can look and go, you know, I think you're beautiful, but maybe that doesn't look great. That's actually a loving statement, because I think I can make the argument that outside of your home, who cares what you look like or smell like or anything else? There's one woman that I care about her opinion on the way that I look. Her name is Alicia Browning. And because whenever I ask her, hey, what do you think, that she has that much of credibility with me, I really want the truth. I think there's a lot of wives that feel the same way. And I think we rob them of the honesty. We rob them of the integrity. We rob them of the credibility if we don't just look at them and tell them the truth.
I was going to say, I was thinking about reading that question, and I don't know that I would say it's necessarily a white lie, but maybe some people think about it as a small lie. So like growing up, I mean, all kids lie. All kids do that. But my mom always said this, and we find ourselves saying this to our kids now, but you know, as a kid, if you find yourself willing to lie about the little things, if it's a little lie, if it's a small lie, it's not a big deal, it's just a little lie. If you're willing to lie about the little things, then who's to say that you're not willing to lie about the big things?
Yeah, I think it was Edgar Allan Poe that wrote, Oh, the webs of lies we weave when we choose to deceive.
Mm-hmm.
And how you'll look up, and before you know it, you're all mangled and in a mess of these little lies. And I mean, think about it this way too. So if I'm willing to tell the truth, that credibility over time I'm having that integrity in all the rooms. What that will afford you later is actually a great reward. You know, if we're just always, yeah, honey, you look great. On the day that she really does look great and you want her to know and you really want to give her that compliment, how much weight is it going to carry if in the past you were willing to say when you didn't look great? What this really bumps up against is the very real honesty, integrity, and credibility you have with the people that you should love the most. It gets back to what you were saying earlier, Michael, whenever you referred to the part of the sermon, we were talking about those most important commitments. That most important commitment within your family, which is where a lot of these white lies are told, really, really matter. It really will only bolster the commitment you have with one another.
Yeah. Well, I love, too, the second part of that question. You know, did they suffer before they died? We're all parents sitting around this table, too. And I think, you know, we all have opportunities to be honest with our kids about hard things. Mm-hmm. You know, when my kids ask me difficult questions like that, if I pad the truth to maybe soften the blow for them and their small hearts, what I'm also doing is robbing them of running to their Heavenly Father for the comfort that they ultimately need. Mm. You know, so when I try to mediate that, I'm keeping them from going directly to Him with the hard things because I'm trying to put that barrier up for them to deal with real world hurt and problems, which ultimately is because of the fall of sin.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so my job is to direct them to Him, not to make life easier for them in the meantime.
Yeah, on something like an end-of-life statement like that, especially if we have a lot of confirmation that they had, by faith, believed in Jesus, then pivoting away from the state that they were when they breathed their last and talking about the real lack of suffering they had the moment they opened their eyes and they were in the presence of Jesus, like that roots in something hopeful.
Hope, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, the hope.
Yeah. So that, did they suffer at the end? Well, I know they're not suffering now.
Right.
You know? Yeah. And you can, I mean, I'm basing my whole life on that reality. So getting caught up in how someone, whenever they breathe their last and forsaking what they were when they opened their eyes for the first time on the other side, I think is a very beautiful way to deal and avoid a compassionate lie.
Right.
So you come to First Salina, we are going to tell you the truth. Please don't come up to us this week as this is on our minds and ask us how you look. Don't force us into an awkward conversation.
Honesty is built on integrity, and integrity is built on credibility.
All right, we're going to tell you.
We love you, First Salina.
Hey, this is the last question of this week's episode, and it is a doozy. Here it is. How could a Christian who has compromised their integrity in the workplace reestablish their reputation?
So every week, whenever I'm thinking through the sermon, there are always going to be phrases that I'm saying on purpose each week and every week. That's my way of hoping that I'm catechizing the people in the audience. I want for them to see a stream of thought that really matters, and I hope that maybe it stands out over time so that they can say, hey, one of the things I learned during that preaching series is fill in the blank. And that statement this time has been, it's never too late to do the right thing. I've said it at least once every single sermon so far. So whenever someone is taking seriously their integrity in the workplace and how they reestablish that, I would want you to know that it is never too late to do the right thing. But of course, the question here isn't just, can I do that? It's how do I do that? And I would love to know what you guys are thinking as you're reading this question.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things to remember with starting to do the right thing is that it's going to take time. Like the harsh reality of sin, the harsh reality of changing the narrative around you is that it's just going to take some time. It's going to take effort. However, we have an amazing God-given tool for all of us as humans. We can use like no one else. No one else on creation can use. And that is that we can apologize. That is an extra thing we can do. We can make those people aware that, hey, we know what we did wrong. We know what we were in the wrong here. I want to do better now. Now, that does double the pressure, right? You can use that tool, but if you've been dishonest in the past, you need to be honest from here on out, right? You've got to fully shift and be marked by integrity, by honesty.
And I really loved that, Pastor Jacob, you brought that back every week. And in that it's never too late. It's never too late if you're in the wrong, whatever it is, whatever Jesus is preaching here through the Sermon on the Mount. Today is the day that you can turn that around. So if it's lying or if it's lust or if it's whatever else, fill in the blank, that's what grace does. That's what Jesus does. It's always and never too late. Never too late.
I think our humanness is really, we make things a lot harder sometimes than they need to be. You know, Jesus is very, his way back is very simple, right? But it can feel like, you know, how to eat an elephant one bite at a time. But it does take those small, faithful steps back in the other direction. And I think over time, as you give opportunities for people to see that the change is like really for real, and you're not just putting up a front, you know, that's going to take more than a few minutes. You know, that's going to take a lot of different interactions and opportunities for people to see that you're genuinely a different person. But what better witness to people, number one, to show the humility that you recognize the way you were living was wrong, but number two, that you're willing to put in the hard work over time to show that you're really changed and that what he's done in you is lasting and legit.
That's good.
Yeah, that's really good, Anna. What better witness? I love that. When I think of this question, one of the most difficult things I think people will encounter whenever they've compromised their integrity in the workplace is the thought of, I'm never going to be able to get it back. What I've done is just too wrong, or what I've said, it's been too hurtful. There's no way I can come back out of it. And ironically enough, I actually recently watched the movie Radio, not for the first time. I know it's a classic. We've all seen it. But if you remember the movie Radio, he's a young man who gets bullied by another young man named Johnny Clay, who's a star running back of the team. And he puts him in a shed, and he makes him run into the girls' locker room. He does all these horrible things. And you, at the beginning of the movie, you just really don't like him as a character. But then he changes, his heart towards Radio changes, and towards the end of the movie, you start to pull for him because he's doing the right thing. Like Pastor Jacob said, it's never too late. And what it boils down to is just the idea of redemption and knowing that we have that in our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Amen. I love the how-ness of this question. Like, how do I actually do that? Out of all of these four, I think that each of these four questions have been very important to ask. So thank you, audience. What an amazing job you guys are doing. Keep it up. We love it. This is probably my favorite question, this one right here, because it gets down to the brass tacks of how do I do it. One of the reasons why I've thought that this has been the best sermon ever, and I actually had a moment during the sermon on Sunday where I thought I put my foot in my mouth a little bit, because one of the things I think is so clever and so incredible about, the way that Jesus is communicating in this sermon early on is he starts off with these blessed attitudes. So if you're just reading in order where we are in the sermon, which is we're still in chapter 5, we're just in these, I mean, it's verses 33 through 37 when we're talking about lying. I mean, Jesus just talked about the blessed attitudes just like seconds ago, minutes ago. For us, it was weeks ago. So bringing back up the blessed attitudes will help us to understand the how on this. Those blessed attitudes are broken into three categories. And right now, this question is talking about the doing, which is mercy, purity, and peacemakers. But don't forget that these blessed attitudes is a full portrait of things. So you're never going to get to the blessed attitudes of doing, that mercy that we all desire, and we will receive if we show mercy, that purity, which is God's best, and the peacemakers, which is reconciliation at all costs. You can't rob that of the blessed attitude of dependence and desire. So step one, if this is you and you're trying to think through, how can I gain back integrity and honesty and credibility in the workplace? The first thing you got to do is you got to confess it. Like, every person has received an apology and wondered to themselves, are they just apologizing because they want to move on? Are they trying to avoid consequences? I mean, my little five-year-old, he's quick to apologize. And I'll ask him, well, why are you saying I'm sorry? He didn't have a clue. Right. And the reality is that we are all thinking that from time to time when someone comes up to us with an apology. It's like, why are you apologizing, really? This is where that blessed attitude of dependence comes in, which is in verse 3 of chapter 5, that poor in spirit. you've got to come to a real place in your own heart where you're spiritually bankrupt. Just like when a computer loses all of its charge, it needs an outside source to charge it up. Poor in spirit means you need an outside source to help you. And the only reason you would ever get there is in verse 4, because you're mourning your sin. That meekness in verse 5 talks about bringing power under control. So confessing your need for forgiveness and your need for God is going to be step one in how can you regain a compromised integrity and honesty in the workplace. Because that desire, which is that verse 6, that blessed attitude of desire, no longer are you thinking about preservation. You know, I talked about in the sermon on Sunday that there's three reasons why we oftentimes will appeal to an oath or will lie. Number one, for assurance. Number two, when there's an argument. And number three, whenever we're being accused of something. If righteousness becomes the insatiable desire of your heart, if you hunger and thirst for righteousness, that's going to help you with those moments whenever you're being tempted to lie. Now we're ready to talk about the doing. If you will show people a real desire to confess and apologize and show them that your only desire is righteousness, you start to tell the truth in previous areas where you were telling lies. I believe that's when mercy, purity, and peacemaking are going to take place. It's never too late to do the right thing. And every step of the way, whenever how pops into your mind, appeal back to those blessed attitudes. I believe that's why Jesus began the sermon that way. That blessed attitude of dependence, blessed attitude of desire, and the blessed attitude of doing. Thank you so very much for tuning in this week. We are looking forward to this Sunday's sermon, Keeping It Salty, on the topic of retaliation. We're going to be in Matthew chapter 5, verses 38 through 42. We cannot wait to hear what questions come from the audience. Please follow or subscribe to the podcast. We would love to see you this week at our service, which starts at 10:30.